This podcast comes to you from the Wicket Gate magazine, which is part of the ministry of the Reformed Baptist Church, Inverness, Scotland. The lecture you are about to hear was given by the pastor of the church, Dr. Nick Needham, and was given in two parts. This podcast is the first of the two. The title of the lecture is Isaac Watts, His Life and Work.
Southampton is on the south coast of England, between Bournemouth and Portsmouth. Southampton at that time was not what it is today. It was not yet a city, only a town, and it had a population of only a few thousand. Even that small population had been devastated by the Great Plague of 1665. When the plague struck Southampton, the better off fled in panic. The town lost its prosperity, and the deserted streets, we are told, were overgrown with vegetation. Now, as far as religion is concerned, Watts belonged to a dissenting family. And we'll have to pause a moment to explain what that means. England had experienced one of the greatest upheavals in its history in the period 1640 to 60, the period of the English Civil War and its aftermath. The Civil War resulted in the overthrow both of the monarchy and the Anglican Church. Monarchy and church had been intertwined ever since the English Reformation, when Henry VIII had broken with the papacy and put himself at the head of the Anglican Church. The English Civil War had a religious as well as a political dimension. The opponents of the then king, Charles I, opposed him on religious as well as political grounds. They wanted not only a king more accountable to Parliament, but also a national church more thoroughly Protestant and reformed in its worship and organisation. Those who sought this were nicknamed Puritans. So when actual civil war broke out in England between King Charles and his opponents, almost all of those with Puritan sympathies fought for Parliament against the king. As often happens in a civil war, positions became more radical, and the parliamentary army was soon dominated by, as it were, left-wing Puritans who were ready to go the whole way in destroying rather than reforming the monarchy and the Anglican Church. This was what happened in 1649, the year that King Charles was publicly put to death by the victorious Puritan army of Oliver Cromwell. The monarchy was then abolished and the Anglican Church outlawed. Cromwell's Puritan regime, however, was unable to survive his own death in 1658, and in 1660 the monarchy was restored in the person of Charles II, son of Charles I. Together with the monarchy, the Anglican Church also returned to power. And that's where dissent enters the picture. Charles II and his Anglican supporters had expected the English people to conform to the restored Church of England as the national religion. But a significant and fairly numerous minority would not. They were convinced that they could not consistently with their consciences participate in the Anglican system, and so they remained outside the national church. They didn't all agree among themselves about what a church ought to be, but they were of one mind in rejecting Anglicanism. So there were Presbyterians, Congregationalists, or Independents, as they were then called, Baptists, both Calvinist and Arminian, and Quakers. These were now given the title Dissenters for their refusal to conform to the established church. They were made subject to many legal disadvantages, reduced to the level of second-class citizens, and indeed were more often than not forbidden to practice their faith. Many dissenters ended up in prison, in very unhealthy prisons that were a real threat to the lives of those locked up there. The most famous dissenting prisoner was, of course, John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress in Bedford Jail. Such was to be the unhappy lot of the dissenters until 1689, when King James II, brother and successor to Charles II, fled the British throne, replaced by the great Dutch Calvinist, William of Orange. The event is known as the Glorious Revolution. With William came freedom of religion for dissenters. They remained in many ways second-class citizens politically, but they were no longer persecuted for their faith. 1689 marks the year when England finally decided that it would be a nation not of one religion only. Protestants of all sorts were from now on to be granted religious liberty. So the division between Anglicanism and dissent became entrenched in the life of the nation. The English establishment and the majority of English people would be Anglican, but there would from now on always be a powerful dissenting minority who could not be ignored and whose interests were championed in Parliament by the Whig Party. The two political parties at that time were the Whigs and the Tories, the ancestors of the Liberal and Conservative parties. So then, Isaac Watts was born into a dissenting family in Southampton in 1674. His father's name was also Isaac. Isaac Watts Sr. and his wife Sarah were Congregationalists or Independents in religion, and they worshipped in the Above Bar Independent Church, pastored by Nathaniel Robinson. Robinson was one of the 2,000 Puritans who'd been ejected from the ministry of the National Church in 1662, after the restoration of the monarchy and of Anglicanism. Isaac Watts Sr. was a deacon in his church. He was obviously a man of courage and conviction in religious matters, because in the same year that Isaac Watts Jr. was born, 1674, Isaac Sr. was put in prison for his dissent. There are stories of his wife Sarah visiting him in prison, carrying the newly born Isaac Jr. in her arms. There's some confusion about Isaac Watts Sr.'s occupation. Different sources describe him as a maker or a seller of cloth, and also as the master of a boarding school. Quite possibly he was both. In 1683, Isaac Sr. was again imprisoned for dissent. On his release, he spent 2 years away from his family and church in internal exile in London. Isaac Watts Jr. was the first of 8 children. He was a small and sickly child, we're told, and indeed he would be dogged by serious ill health throughout his life. It seems that his gift of poetry was evident from early childhood. We have this composition that he wrote at the age of 7. You should have this on the photocopied sheet there. The first letter in each line spells out his name. I am a vile, polluted lump of earth, so I've continued ever since my birth. Although Jehovah grace does daily give me, as sure this monster, Satan, will deceive me. Come therefore, Lord, from Satan's claws, relieve me. Wash me in thy blood, O Christ, and grace divine impart. Then search and try the corners of my heart, that I in all things may be fit to do service to thee and sing thy praises too. By modern standards, the young Isaac was a prodigy of learning. He went to a school at the age of 6 where Latin was the language used. So he had to learn Latin in order to go there. So Isaac Watts Sr. taught him Latin from the age of 4. The school was the Free School of Southampton, where the tutor was John Pinhorn. Pinhorn was the Anglican rector of All Saints Church in Southampton. Despite the official hostility between Anglicans and dissenters, it seems that Pinhorn was of a more liberal turn of mind. And he and his dissenting pupil, Isaac, got on very well with each other. We're told that Isaac became very warmly attached to Pinhorn, and Pinhorn often foretold the future greatness of Isaac. As I said, Isaac was a prodigy of learning by modern standards. Not only did he learn Latin at the age of 4, at age 9 he learned Greek, at age 10 he learned French, and at age 13 he learned Hebrew. So by the time he was 13, he knew Latin, Greek, French, and Hebrew. Isaac wouldn't have been so much of an infant wonder in his own day, because others too would have had similar accomplishments. So I suppose that children today are either less capable or else we underestimate what they're capable of and pamper them. It was while Isaac was at school, aged 15, that he was converted. In a brief memorandum that he wrote, he says, "Fell under considerable conviction of sin, 1688, and was taught to trust in Christ, I hope, 1689. So in a strange coincidence, the year of Isaac Watts's conversion was the year of the Glorious Revolution, the year that England was liberated from King James II, with William of Orange ascending the throne. Not long after this, young Isaac became convinced that God was calling him into the preaching ministry. But he had a decision to make. His schooling over in 1690, he was now ready, at the age of 16, for university. However, one of the restrictions that dissenters continued to suffer, even after the Glorious Revolution, was that only Anglicans were allowed to take their degrees at the two universities, Oxford and Cambridge. There were only those two universities in England at that time. Local Anglicans in Southampton were so impressed by young Isaac, they offered to finance him at Oxford or Cambridge, but the condition was that Isaac would give up his dissent and conform to the Church of England. This was too high a price for Isaac, and he declined. He would not become an Anglican, not even to obtain an Oxbridge degree. So instead of going to university, Isaac went to a dissenting academy in London at Stoke Newington Green, run by the Reverend Thomas Rowe. This was on the outskirts of London, a village surrounded by cornfields. Thomas Rowe, in addition to running the academy, was also the minister of the Independent Church at Girdler's Hall, and on Sunday the academy students worshipped there. Now, dissenting academies were colleges of higher education set up by dissenters for their sons in view of their exclusion from the universities. Usually, a dissenting academy was run by one tutor, often a minister with no church, although Thomas Rowe at the Stoke Newington Academy did also have a church, as we've seen. The tutor would gather 20 or 30 young men in his home and put them through 4 years of fairly intensive study. Typical subjects taught in a dissenting academy were Latin, Greek, Hebrew, maths, history, geography, biology, rhetoric, ethics, philosophy, anatomy, law, and theology. The 16-year-old Isaac Watts went specifically in order to prepare for the preaching ministry at his academy in Stoke Newington. And as well as his academic study, he also prepared himself by listening to the greatest dissenting preachers of the London of his day, such as the great Puritan John Howe, who had been Oliver Cromwell's chaplain. In 1694, Watts finished his time at the academy and spent the next 2 years at home. He wrote many of his hymns during this period, but we'll come back in the second talk and look at Watts as a hymn writer. Then in 1696, he became the private tutor to the son of Sir John Hartopp. Sir John was a dissenting millionaire and member of Parliament. He was a pious man. His house was always open to ministers for the discussion of theology, and Sir John himself learned Hebrew at the age of 50 in order to study his Old Testament better. The depth of Sir John's commitment to dissent is shown by the fact that he was fined a total of £7,000 during the reign of James II for his refusal to conform to Anglicanism. Now, £7,000 in the late 17th century would have been a vast fortune in today's money. At his death in 1722, Sir John left £10,000 as a bequest for the training of dissenting ministers. Watts then spent 2 years in the godly dissenting household of Sir John Hartopp as tutor to his son. Then in February 1698, Watts at last entered the ministry. He became the pastoral assistant to Isaac Chauncey, the minister of Mark Lane Independent Church in London. This was the church where Sir John Hartopp was a member. It was perhaps London's most distinguished dissenting church of that time. Its previous ministers included the illustrious John Owen, often regarded as the greatest of all the English Puritan theologians. Owen was minister there from 1673 to 83. The church was full of members who had played a prominent part in the government of Oliver Cromwell, or at least had married into families connected with the old Cromwellian regime. So it was a church overflowing with history and with distinction. There was Charles Fleetwood and Charles Desborough, two of Cromwell's generals. There was Bridget Ireton, Cromwell's granddaughter. There was John Owen's widow. There were people from the ranks of the nobility, such as Lady Vere Wilkinson and Lady Havisham, daughter of the Earl of Anglesey. And there was Sir Thomas and Lady Abney, who were destined to play a crucial and long-lasting part in Watts's life. Sir Thomas was an MP and at one point was elected Lord Mayor of London. This was no ordinary congregation. It was, in many ways, a rather aristocratic, rather refined, well-bred congregation, a distinguished and cultured congregation, the cream of the cream of Old English Puritanism. Now, Isaac Chauncey had been the minister at Mark Lane Independent Church since 1687. It would have to be said that he was not a success, and this was chiefly because he preached so often and so exclusively about church government and church discipline to the neglect of the eternal issues of salvation, by which he at last preached away most of his people, as one historian puts it. By the time Chauncey resigned in April 1701, membership in the church had declined from 171 to 74. During the time that Watts was his pastoral assistant, Chauncey preached in the morning and Watts in the afternoon. With Chauncey's resignation, this left Watts as the de facto minister of the Mark Lane Church, but they didn't immediately think of calling him to that position officially. They looked around for someone else. However, within 11 months, the church unanimously called Watts to be their minister in January 1702. Why had it taken so long to come to this decision? Partly, it was owing to Watts's ill health. He had been a sickly child, and he was now often ill in adulthood. Sometimes, indeed, he was prostrate and bedridden for days on end. Watts initially declined the first invitations of his church to succeed Chauncey, giving as his reason his continuing ill health. But eventually he gave in to their entreaties. Now, in those days among independents, although a church elected its own minister, the approval of other ministers was thought necessary before a man could actually take up his position in a congregation. So there was a church meeting on March the 18th, 1702, at which six independent ministers gave their public testimony as to Watts's fitness for the ministry. Then one of the deacons gave an address to the church. "Do you all agree to choose Mr. Isaac Watts to the office of a pastor in this church, and promise to submit yourselves accordingly to him in the Lord?" All the male members answered, "Aye." Then a sermon was preached by Thomas Rowe, Watts's old tutor at the Stoke Newington Academy, and one of the six ministers who'd given public testimony to his fitness for the ministry. It may be of interest to know how a typical independent church was organized in Watts's day. Generally, there was a pastor, or sometimes more than one pastor, if the church deemed it necessary. And as we'll see, the Mark Lane church under Watts did end up with two pastors. There was one who occupied the office of teacher, who acted as a pastoral assistant. There was a body of elders who acted as a sort of advisory council on church matters to the pastor or pastors. And there was a body of deacons who collected and distributed the charity of the church. During the first 8 years of his ministry, 1702-10, Watts lived in the house of Thomas Hollis. Hollis was another of these wealthy dissenters of that period. Now, we don't really know much about Watts's own activities over these years. We do know that in 1703 his health broke down again and he suffered a long illness. The church appointed an assistant to help the stricken Watts, Samuel Price. Price and Watts worked very well together. Price didn't have any of Watts's great gifts, but he was, by all accounts, a good, gentle, modest man who earned Watts's complete confidence. In 1704, the church moved to new premises in Pinner's Hall, and then in 1708 it moved again to a specially constructed building in Berry Street. Why these moves? Basically, in order to accommodate a huge growth in membership. There were 60 members in 1702 when Watts was ordained. The new building in Berry Street seated 428. This demonstrates how amazingly popular Watts was proving to be as a London preacher. And yet, Watts's popularity as a preacher didn't come from the sort of things one might expect. He did not have a forceful or imposing personality. He was a very gentle person. Neither did Watts possess an impressive physical appearance. He was only 5 feet tall. In his biography, David Fountain describes Watts as not even a moderately presentable Englishman, but a minute, sallow-faced anatomy with hook nose, prominent cheekbones, heavy countenance, pale complexion, and small grey eyes. His voice had rather feminine qualities, delicate and slender, not at all what one would imagine in a popular preacher. So why was Watts so popular? Partly it was because he had a serious, dignified manner. When he spoke about spiritual things, people knew he was a man who took such things very seriously. He also had a great command of the English language, which he put to imaginative use in his preaching. However, his greatest virtue as a preacher was his simplicity. Watts rebelled violently against the common practice of evangelical preachers in his day, what he called branching sermons. A branching sermon was one in which the preacher divided up his subject into branches, and each branch had a sub-branch, and each sub-branch probably had a sub-sub-branch. The result was a sermon so endlessly divided and subdivided that it taxed and strained the listener grievously to follow the structure of what was being said. It was the kind of sermon where the preacher might say, "And seventhly, we must consider the following point first," and he would then divide up his first into four more sub-points. Watts commented that Ezekiel's vision of the Valley of Bones came into his mind when he listened to all these divisions and subdivisions. Behold, they were very many and very dry. Well, Watts totally rejected this whole style of preaching. His passion was to make everything simple and clear to his hearers, easy to follow. So the branches and the divisions went, and Watts would concentrate on making a few simple points as clearly as he could. He carried his passion for simplicity and clarity into his delivery, too. He pronounced every word so clearly that no one could mistake what he was saying. This seems to have been the secret of Watts's popularity as a preacher. I don't know if Watts had read Martin Luther, but Luther's advice on preaching was that he tried to preach in such a way that the most average brain in the congregation would be able to go away and say, that's what the sermon was about. Well, Isaac Watts was very much a Lutheran in that sense. In the earlier half of his life, Watts wrote out his sermons in full. In the latter part of his life, he wrote outlines and filled them up in the act of preaching. One distinct characteristic of Watts in preaching was that if he said something he considered particularly important, he would pause a while before continuing to let the congregation digest what he'd said. Many of Watts's sermons were published. For example, Sermons on Various Subjects Divine and Moral, Volume 1, 1720, Volume 2, 1723, Volume 3, 1729, and The World to Come, Part 1, 1739, Part 2, 1745. Watts's popularity as a preacher means that he was one of those who kept the flame of evangelical faith burning in a period of great spiritual decline in Britain. The Glorious Revolution of 1689 may have brought religious liberty to dissenters, but it also heralded a nationwide falling away from vital Christianity. The next 50 years were to be a dry, barren time. Evangelical religion in the Church of England became almost extinct until Whitfield and Wesley arose to revitalize it. And meanwhile, things were not very good among the dissenters either. The largest and most influential dissenting body, the Presbyterians, were fast declining into heresy. Soon, evangelical religion would be totally extinct among them, as they increasingly abandoned their belief in the Trinity and the deity of Christ. The same happened among the General Baptists, that is, the Arminian Baptists. The Independents and the Particular Baptists, that is, the Calvinistic Baptists, held on to their basic orthodoxy, but especially among the Particular Baptists, there was a widespread drift into hyper-Calvinism, which tended to produce a rather inward-looking faith with no concern to evangelize. As evangelical religion reached this low ebb, both in the established church and among the dissenters, society at large became ever more scornful of Christianity, ever more sunk in worldliness and vice. Soon a joke was doing the rounds that Parliament was considering a bill to remove the word not from the Ten Commandments, but insert it into the creed. The French philosopher Montesquieu visited England in 1728, and he commented, "There was no religion in England. Everyone laughs if one talks of it." John Wesley was soon to say, "What is the present characteristic of the English nation? It is ungodliness. Ungodliness is our universal, our constant, our peculiar character." Well, this was the period when Isaac Watts was active, very much a day of decline, a day when evangelical religion and even Christianity itself had fallen on desperately hard times. It seems that the providential calling of Isaac Watts was to hold up the evangelical torch amid the surrounding darkness until it pleased the Sun of Righteousness to rise and shine once more, as he did in the late 1730s with the great evangelical revival. Watts lived to witness the first decade of that revival, although in some ways he had mixed feelings about it, as we'll see. Still, Watts held the torch during the decades of darkness, and did so with such faithfulness that he was widely regarded by dissenters as the ideal minister. It became the holy ambition of those aspiring to the ministry to be like Isaac Watts. In 1705, Watts's first publication appeared. This was a book of poems, not hymns, poems, entitled Horae Lyricae, Lyrical Poems. It was also around this time that Watts's famous relationship with Elizabeth Singer developed. Elizabeth Singer was a godly young dissenting woman, the same age as Watts, and she too was a poet, and she'd fallen in love with Watts's poetry, as found in his Horae Lyricae, and so she went to see him. A warm friendship sprang up between the two dissenting poets. Elizabeth was not only a very cultured young woman, but very beautiful, too. Now, there's some disagreement among historians about how true this is, but tradition has it that Watts became enchanted with Elizabeth and asked her to marry him, but that she declined. She is alleged to have said, "Mr. Watts, I only wish I could say that I admire the casket as much as I admire the jewel." In other words, she admired Watts's mind, but didn't find him physically attractive. She had, in any case, the previous day consented to another proposal of marriage. Now, as I say, there is disagreement among historians about how true that story is, or whether it's a bit of a legend. At any rate, the friendship between Watts and Elizabeth was genuine, a very affectionate friendship, and it endured. And on Elizabeth's death in 1737, she bequeathed her poetry to Watts with a request that he should edit it for publication, which he did. If indeed Watts was enchanted with Elizabeth Singer, he certainly never seems to have been interested in any other woman, and he remained a lifelong bachelor. There never was to be a Mrs. Isaac Watts. In 1707, Watts published his epoch-making Hymns and Spiritual Songs. This was to be the first part of his System of Praise. The second part, the Psalms of David Imitated, came out in 1719. These changed the face of English worship. That is no exaggeration. However, we'll come back in the second talk and consider the part that Watts played in that revolution. In 1712, Watts fell prey to a serious illness of 4 years' duration, which we're told permanently affected his nerves. It was a horrendous 4 years. Watts's own description of what he suffered is enough to give anyone nightmares. "Oh, 'tis all confusion. If I but close my eyes, strange images in thousand forms and thousand colours rise, stars, rainbows, moons, green dragons, bears, and ghosts." In this critically afflicted state, Watts moved into the home of Sir Thomas Abney in Cheshunt in Hertfordshire for rest and quiet. In fact, he was to remain with the Abney family for the rest of his days. They became his adoptive family, as it were. So there was a silver lining in the cloud of his illness. Watts got on extremely well with the Abney family, and they took to him, and he simply became one of the family for the rest of his earthly life. When the Countess of Huntingdon visited Watts in the Abney home in 1742, Watts said to her, "Madam, your ladyship is come to see me on a very remarkable day. This very day, 30 years ago, I came hither to the house of my good friend Sir Thomas Abney, intending to spend but one single week under this friendly roof, and I have extended my visit to the length of exactly 30 years. Lady Abney interrupted him, "Sir, what you term a long 30 years visit, I consider as the shortest visit my family ever received." Sir Thomas Abney was a member of Watts's church and a successful businessman. In fact, he was one of the original directors of the Bank of England. He was also a member of Parliament and at one point the Lord Mayor of London. By all accounts, he was a godly man. He died in 1722, but Watts remained with the family. The other members of the Abney household after Sir Thomas's death were Lady Mary Abney, the widow of Sir Thomas. She took up many of her late husband's responsibilities in connection with publishing and the financing of schools. Joseph Parker, Lady Mary's steward, or in other words, the administrator of the household, who also acted as Watts's secretary. And then there were the three Abney daughters, Sarah, Mary, and Elizabeth. Sarah died in 1732, Mary married and died in 1738, Elizabeth died in 1782, at the ripe age of 78. You may be wondering what happened to Berry Street Independent Church during the 4 years of Watts's prostration under this fearful illness that took him to the Abney household. Well, for that period, 1712 to 16, the work of the church had fallen on Samuel Price, Watts's assistant. On Watts's recommendation, Price was ordained co-pastor of the church in 1713. So from now on, Berry Street had two pastors, not merely a pastor and his assistant. When Watts finally recovered from his illness in 1716, he resumed regular preaching in the Berry Street Church, but he spent as little time as possible in London in order to spare his health. Cities were very unhygienic places in those days. It was much better for the frail Watts to live in the country, surrounded by the affection and care of the Abney family. The rest of Watts's life is fairly uneventful. He continued ministering to the Berry Street Church. He continued writing. In 1728, Edinburgh and Aberdeen universities made him a Doctor of Divinity, which is why he's often referred to as Dr. Watts. Perhaps of special interest is the way that Watts's life overlapped in its final decade with the beginnings of the evangelical revival. The foremost preacher of that revival was George Whitfield, converted in 1735, who began preaching in 1736 with phenomenal effect. Together with others, like John and Charles Wesley, Howell Harris, and Daniel Rowland, the revival preachers were to be instrumental in setting a fire that would eventually change the spiritual face of Britain. Now, Watts had been holding aloft the torch of evangelical religion through all those dark years of the early 1700s. Surely he would welcome the revival. Strangely, the answer is that he only half welcomed the revival. His relations with George Whitfield, its preeminent figure, were very ambiguous. Whitfield, of course, knew all about the famous and venerable Dr. Watts, and visited him in 1739, perhaps hoping for Watts's blessing. Watts, however, stood somewhat aloof. Although he was glad to see the gospel being preached with such power by the young Whitfield, who was only 25, he felt that there were things in Whitfield's attitudes and behaviour that were indefensible and were bringing the gospel into disrepute. Partly this was because Whitfield, in those early days of his preaching, claimed a direct divine inspiration and guidance, which Watts felt was unbalanced and fanatical. Whitfield was too emotional in his preaching for Watts, and far too prone to condemn from the pulpit anyone who didn't agree with him. Watts told Whitfield so quite bluntly. "I said many things to warn him of the danger of delusion and to guard him against the irregularities and imprudences which youth and zeal might lead him into, and told him so plainly that though I believed him very sincere and desirous to do good to souls, yet I was not convinced of any extraordinary call he had to some parts of his conduct." This ambiguity on the part of Watts towards Whitfield soon hardened into a definite coolness. So in 1742, we find Watts complaining that Whitfield had, quote, "a narrow zeal for the Church of England as a party," unquote, which made him unwelcome among dissenters. Watts's attitude here was actually typical of dissenters towards the revival. We have to remember that the first generation of revival preachers in England and Wales were all Anglicans. The traditional hostility between Anglicanism and dissent seems to have muddied the waters when the evangelical revival occurred among Anglicans. There were some exceptions. Philip Doddridge, the independent minister, was warmly disposed towards Whitfield, and the great Anglican revival preacher Augustus Toplady virtually worshipped John Gill the Baptist. But by and large, dissenters found Anglican revival preachers too emotional, too disorderly, and just too Anglican for their tastes. So, while it would be pleasant to record that Isaac Watts rejoiced to see the great revival of religion under Whitfield and the Wesleys, the truth is he had very mixed feelings about it. And his relationship with Whitfield in particular fizzled out into coldness. But now, what of Isaac Watts, the man? What can we say of him as an individual human being? As I said earlier, he didn't have a forceful or imposing personality, and in fact it's very hard to get a handle on Watts's personality at all. Partly because he hardly ever spoke about himself, partly because we have very few records of his day-to-day life. If, however, we had to pick out the prominent features in his character and personality, it would perhaps be the following. Watts was a very self-effacing and gentle person. His humility, one commentator said, like a deep shade, set off his other graces and virtues and made them shine with greater lustre. This, in fact, was sometimes held against him. When Watts wrote against the religious errors of his day, he was so courteous and so gracious to his opponents, some people found it hard to believe that Watts could really see anything very wrong with their views. This was especially the case with those who denied the deity of Christ, and it led to some suspicion that Watts was secretly in sympathy with their denial. The real explanation was probably his extreme mildness and tenderness of disposition. In a positive way, this came out in his yearning for unity among all evangelicals. He maintained cordial relations with evangelicals in all denominations, including the Anglican Church, as long as your name wasn't George Whitfield. In those days, Anglicans were often quite fierce against dissenters, but no Anglican could find it in his heart to be fierce against Isaac Watts. He won the esteem even of the celebrated Dr. Samuel Johnson, no evangelical, but an ardent Anglican who usually poured out the vials of his wrath against anyone who wasn't an Anglican. The crabby and opinionated Dr. Johnson had nothing but praise for Isaac Watts. He particularly admired Watts's treatise, Orthodoxy and Charity United, written to show that orthodoxy in faith must be allied to charity in life. Dr. Johnson said, it was not only in his book, but in his mind, that orthodoxy was united with charity. Watts's generosity of temper extended to money matters. He regularly gave away a third of his income to charity. Watts shone in conversation. One of his biographers tells us that his conversational wit was like an ethereal flame, ever vivid and penetrating. At the end of the day, however, there's no doubt that Watts was an intensely private man. He lived in his mind. Contemplation of truth was his supreme activity. Always thinking, always writing, even on horseback. Perhaps Watts himself summed up his personality best in some famous lines he wrote. Were I so tall to reach the pole and grasp the ocean in a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind's the standard of the man. The later years of Watts were plagued by severe insomnia. He simply couldn't sleep without taking drugs. In 1739, he suffered a paralytic stroke, which left him permanently feeble. In 1746, Philip Doddridge, the other great dissenting minister of that time, wrote to his wife that poor Dr. Watts is no more himself. He seems to have become deranged, at least for a time, although some historians dispute that Watts's affliction ever led to actual madness. Certainly it led to a dark depression of some sort. Partly this was brought on by a violent rupture between Watts and his nephew, James Braxton. Watts himself, usually a most gentle and charitable man, had this to say: "As for my nephew, James Braxton, I would have you for the future neither send nor write anything to him relating to me. He has dealt so wickedly and shamefully with me that our church has cast him out a great while ago, and I have done with him entirely." Philip Doddridge definitely traced Watts's derangement to the impact made on him by this rupture with his nephew. 2 years before Watts's death, Doddridge wrote in 1746, "His nephew, once so great a favourite, has done something to vex him, and his poor weak spirits cannot bear it, so that he is quite amazed and even stupefied with it, to such a degree as hardly to take notice of anything about him. Insomuch that though he knew my chief reason for coming from Bath was to see him, he hardly took any notice of me." So, although some historians don't think that Watts actually lost his mind, Doddridge's testimony is quite decisive that Watts came pretty close to it, and that in some senses he was mentally and emotionally a broken man. No one has been able to find out what exactly his nephew did to upset him so much, so it remains shrouded in painful mystery. During the closing year of his life, when anyone asked Watts how he was, he simply said, "Waiting God's leave to die." Well, Watts obtained God's leave and died on November the 25th, 1748. He was buried in Bunhill Fields in London, the great dissenting burial ground, where the mortal remains are to be found of John Owen, John Bunyan, John Gill, Joseph Hart, and other dissenting heroes. At his request, Watts's funeral was presided over by two Presbyterian ministers, two Independents, and two Baptists. Watts's final testimony to how deeply he valued spiritual unity among evangelical believers. Although I notice there are no Anglicans there. Well, that's the end of part one, so we'll have a break at this point.